You want to welcome Mike this morning?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here today. Jeremy, thank you for the message you shared with us last night. Unfortunately, I missed out on that, but people haven't stopped talking about it, so I know it must have been great. And Merlin, this morning, thank you for leading us in worship. If you were here last night, and obviously if you're here this morning, I have to admit something to you. In the spirit of owning my own weaknesses, I think the highlight of the conference is over. It's all downhill from here. So if you'd like to leave, you're welcome to do so, and I won't take offense. I say that honestly because I don't consider myself an expert in human resources. I've been doing this for a number of years, but that doesn't mean I know what I'm doing. In fact, oftentimes, many days, I realize how little I know about working with people and what this is really all about. We're really working together. I know I don't look like I could have been doing this for 25 years. I'm really only in my mid-40s. I'm 57, and with that, but I'm thrilled to be here. I've seen a few things, I've read some stuff, I've made some colossal mistakes. And so with all that, I'm happy to share with you what I do know and what I've seen, but we're really doing this all together, and so it's a pleasure for you to be here. And quite frankly, spending some time with like-minded folks who also enjoy the value of good homemade pie as much as I do. So I'm excited about that. I guess you might look at me a little bit like a coach at halftime talking about how we won the big game, or maybe more appropriately, a parent of teenagers bragging about how well my kids turned out. Because this is a journey, we're always working with people, and as 18-year-olds, they can be unpredictable, they can change their minds, and our employees often do. Am I doing something wrong?
We're just messing with it.
Okay. You're turning it off, I know. It's, I understand. So I want to ask you to picture in your minds something I've been sharing with our employees for the last couple of years. It's a boat. It's a large boat floating in the water, and in it there are 10 people. Two people at the front of the boat are actively rowing. They have oars in hand. They're moving the boat forward. They're actively engaged. And these represent the 20% of people in most organizations who are actively bought in to your mission. They're excited about coming to work every day. They're in it with you, and they're doing everything they can to help advance your organization. 20% of the American workforce today is engaged. In the middle of the boat, five people, exactly 50% of most organizations today, are unengaged. They're just floating. Either they're tired, they are discouraged, they may be, they're not convinced of the direction you're trying to take them, so they're waiting to see what's going to happen. They're not committed, they're not doing any harm, but they're also not helping any. That's five people in the middle. In the end, at the end of the boat, the back end, three people are dropping anchor. They're working against you. They are convinced whatever you're trying to do is not working, and they could have said that long ago, and they're working actively to try to convince other people to drop anchor with them or to row against whatever your idea is. They think it's not going to work. Those working with you, those two people at the front of the boat, most likely, Gallup would tell us, those folks have been with you very little time. They're still new. The honeymoon is still in full bloom. They're excited, or they've been with you for more than 5 years, and they have realized that this is all, it's true. They're excited. They want to work with you and get some things done. In the middle of the boat, you might have those people between 2 and 4 years who the honeymoon is over, so now they're trying to figure out if this is really what they want to do for the rest of their lives or not. Are they in? Are they going to make a difference? Or is it time for them to jump ship? Or maybe they're just going through the motions. They're not working against you. They come to work. They're doing their jobs, but you're given their heads, but not their hearts. They may not be fully committed. They're quietly quitting. And obviously, those at the end are... They're just No matter what it is you're trying to do, they're going to work against you. How closely does that compare to your organizations? And do you know how many people are rowing with you? How many are on board? And how many are just waiting to see? I'm pleased that at Everence, we have much better numbers than that, than the 20, 50, and 30. But we still have a long way to go to make sure that we can put oars in more people's hands, rowing in the right direction. We survey our people every year, best practice. Gallup surveys their people every 6 months. That seems like a little much to me, but it's important to understand what your people are thinking, how they feel, and whether or not they're really with you. James Marsh is a professor at Stanford, and he says there are two things needed to make sure that employees are thriving at work. He uses terms like poetry and plumbing. So let me explain that for just a minute. He says poetry, those are the stories that you tell. It's the philosophy around what you're doing. It's helping people understand your vision and your mission. It's giving people reason to get up in the morning to get excited about coming to work. Poetry is what motivates people. Plumbing is the stuff needed to get jobs done. Plumbing is policies, it's procedures. In some places it might be bureaucracy. You might have a healthy work environment, but if people are not motivated and inspired, they're not able to do their best. If you have good poetry but no plumbing, people get excited but then discouraged because they want to work with you, but they realize the systems are built against them. If you've got good plumbing in place but no poetry, people can do their jobs, and they will, but they're not excited. They might not know how to talk to other people about what they do because it's directionless. They're doing a job. It's not a career. Proverbs 29:18, it tells us, without vision, people perish. Those are strong words. Without a vision, people perish. And I would suggest the same thing is true in your organizations. Where we work, if we can't give people a vision, if we can't get them excited, they get discouraged and they'll perish or they'll leave. So in my attempts this morning to create a theologically sound message, I have 3 points. I'm going to build on James Marsh's poetry and plumbing and add one more P. And I would suggest the key to helping people thrive at work is by investing in poetry, it's by focusing on plumbing, and it's also a concentration on your people. Poetry, plumbing, and people. So first, let's look at poetry. What is your obsession? What keeps you up at night? What are your dreams? Why are you on this earth? What are you trying to accomplish? And how many people in your organization, A, know those things, and how many share your vision? We can accomplish that by sharing poetry with them. Some of the best organizations among us are making a significant shift in the way they talk to their employees. They're moving away from discussions about a paycheck, and they've started talking about working for a purpose more than for a paycheck. They're moving away from satisfaction and starting to talk about development instead. They're moving away from discussions about a boss and more about a coach. Away from annual reviews and more toward ongoing conversations. Away from weaknesses to focus on strengths. And they're moving away from talking about a job to talking about life. Let me share with you just for a minute a little of my life story. I grew up in Michigan, but actually my story begins long before I came on the earth because my parents met while they were in college at Central Michigan University. My dad grew up on a farm in Michigan. My mom grew up in Mexico. He had done some traveling, realized after working on a farm and working a bit in a factory, he wanted to work in a different setting outside the farm and wasn't thrilled with factory work. He'd done some traveling, went to the Philippines for a while, loved working with kids, and decided, you know, I'd love to be a teacher. So he came back to Michigan, enrolled at Central Michigan University, where he met a young woman from Mexico who was also in some classes of his. She also was coming to Central Michigan. I don't know why you grew up in Mexico and go to Michigan for school, but she did. They met there. He was smitten by her. She less so by him. Nonetheless, they went on a couple of dates, got along well, but she wasn't convinced he was the best fish in this sea. So he saw that, decided to accept it for what it was. He graduated and left, went to Eugene, Oregon, and she was still in school. They stayed in touch by writing letters back and forth. And as she continued to look around and date other men on campus, other young men, losers, if I may say so myself, she realized maybe this guy wasn't so bad after all. And so at one point, her sister was going to be married in Mexico. She wrote my dad a letter and said, "How would you like to come and join me, accompany me to my sister's wedding?" He responded and said, "What do you think about asking your sister if she wants to make the double wedding?" You heard me right. He proposed in a letter. She responded, and again, think about that. She's writing a letter, putting a stamp on it, sending it across the country. She said, "Are you serious?" And that's how she accepted. So he came. There's an important part of the story I forgot to tell you. When my parents married, he was 33, she was 20. I know. Now, dads, think about that for just a minute. Some guy 13 years older than your 20-year-old daughter says he wants to marry you. I don't want to disclose too much, but that might be an excuse for me to go buy a gun. Nonetheless, it worked well. They got married. They never made it to her sister's wedding, by the way. And they were married just before her sister, so I don't know quite how the timing of that worked out. They were married for a good 40 years, had a great life. They had three children. I was number two, their favorite. And several years after my mom passed away, my dad remarried at age 87. And I was his best man. So that was kind of fun. So I tell you that not because, actually it has nothing to do with why we're here, except it's part of my story. It helps people understand who I am and where I've come from. It helps me be rooted to my people, my family, my culture. I have a sister with 12 children. I have another sister who's single. That's weird. You don't need to know that. But it's part of my story. I just have three daughters. Not just, but I have three daughters. That's the reason for the gray hair. There are stories I'm sure many of us could share about our own upbringing, our history, our childhoods. And obviously, it's important for us to get to know the people we work with. And there are stories about your organizations as well. The early years, the founding, the struggles, the challenges. Those are things that are important for people to know and understand. Certainly when you're recruiting and want to attract people to come and work with you. But even after that, it's important to continue to recruit people who work with you and who've been there for some time. Continue to woo your employees, just like you continue to date your spouse, if you're married. If you're not, say that. Several years ago, I worked for Bethel University in Mishawaka, and they had a very lofty mission statement. Most people couldn't recite it. It was hanging in every classroom. It was visible. People walked by, didn't notice it, didn't know anything about it. When you ask people what the mission statement is, they couldn't even find one to show it to you, but they walked by them all the time. So the leadership team at the time decided they needed to do something that would make the mission statement come alive. And they spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out what they wanted to do, how they wanted to be known. They came up with three different values. This was years ago, and I still remember them very, very well because they resonated with me and with others. Loving God and loving people was number one. They said, we're a faith-based organization. It's important for us to love God and be clear about that. We also want to have compassion for people. And if people, new employees or even students, if we're recruiting and they don't understand who we are, if they don't fit within that culture, this isn't going to work well. So they said, number one is loving God and loving people. Number two is having a spirit of humble excellence. They wanted to be really good at what they did, but not self-serving, not bragging, not boasting. But they wanted to excel and to be recognized by their peers. And so they said, we want to be excellent, but let's be humble about that. And the third one was creative grit. The creative part is innovation and doing things a different way and trying to make sure that they could be relevant. Grit speaks to dedication and not giving up and getting through even when times were hard, when we're cutting budgets and laying people off. And there was a lot of that that went on when I was at Bethel. Loving God and people, humble excellence, creative grit. They were easy to understand. They came from the intent of the mission statement, which was much, much longer and much loftier, and no one could understand. But then the magic there was we began to have quarterly celebrations where we would try to put faces on those values. What are people doing to live out these values, and how can we celebrate that? We didn't spend a lot of money, but we invited these people, these honorees, we solicited submissions from our workforce, nominating their peers. We selected the best every quarter. We brought them in, had a light lunch. But then there were pictures and celebrations and telling these stories and showing examples. And those stories resonated throughout the campus and throughout the community and really helped those values come alive, because that was how we were reinforcing what we wanted to be known for, what we wanted to celebrate. And that was part of our poetry at that time. One of my favorite stories growing up has to do with our annual trip to visit my mom's family. My dad had a video camera, a Super 8, I think was the film size. Most of you are way too young to know what I'm talking about, but it was a camera that he would, back in the day before digital photography, you'd have to have film developed. And he had this video camera, no sound, but pictures. And so he'd take pictures of us, have the film developed, and it was actually, it came on reels. We'd have to go put on a projector and show family movies. The one time my family was always together was at picnic lunches. My aunts and uncles and cousins, and we'd all get together. We're sitting in picnics in parks, at picnic tables, eating lunch together, typically Kentucky Fried Chicken. Plug there for KFC. And so my dad is photographing, he's taking pictures of us eating together. Nice story, such as it is. But something told us we could watch those movies backwards. I've never laughed harder than the times when I can remember being in my basement in our home in Michigan, watching movies of people eating backwards, putting chicken back on the bone, filling cups with soda. You know, it was a surreal experience. Great memory. I don't know if those movies are still around. I'm sure the projectors are not. But it's stories like that and memories that we need to keep and hold dear and share with other people, because that's all part of our poetry. Poetry is important, and so is plumbing. There are several examples of companies that have successfully implemented policies and practices that prioritize the well-being of their employees. Google, for example, renowned for its vibrant workplace culture, not just because they have a competitive salary package, but because they have an environment where people feel valued and inspired. From flexible work hours to on-site wellness programs, Google has figured out that when employees feel supported and cared for, they're more engaged, and in turn, they significantly contribute to the company's success. And how many of us use Google products? No need to raise your hands there, I know the answer. I've always thought it was a little backwards when we celebrate people leaving our organization and we ignore the people who come. Think about that for just a minute. People resign and we have pizza parties for them, have a reception, thank them for their service, new people come on board and often feel forgotten or overlooked. Figured out, here's your job, let me know if you have any questions. And that seems a little backwards to me. What kind of an orientation do you have for your employees? What kind of welcome do you provide for them? I think that's one of the keys to understanding how employees can thrive within your organization. I'll just tell you the worst orientation I ever had. Several years ago, I was hired into a company and given a stack of VHS videotapes. I was told to go downstairs, put one in the machine, and watch the tape. When it was over, they said, rewind. That's back in the day when you had to rewind tapes. Take it out, put the next one in, and watch that one. When that one's over, rewind it, take it out, put the next one in. That was my orientation. All morning long, by myself, in a basement, watching one after the other outdated videotapes that had very little relevance to the job I was hired to do. Loved the job, hated the orientation. In contrast, Centere Bank is a local bank not too far west from here, and they have a 3-day orientation that they have all new employees attend. They bring them all to the headquarters, they treat them like royalty, they put them up and they introduce them to several different management team members. It's a hands-on orientation. They call it their foundations class, your foundation into the organization. And they take it very seriously. There's service projects involved, there are meals that they have together. It's huge. And one of the most interesting things about that is at the end of their orientation, they have this ceremony where all new employees are asked to sign a book pledging that they will do their part to help Centere remain independent. One of the core values of Centere is it's an independent bank, and there are getting to be fewer and fewer of those anymore. And so they want all new employees to understand this is our commitment. If you work here, we ask you to commit to this as well. So you could look at this book that several people for years and years have signed the same book. It's under a big banner. They're taking pictures or celebrating. Welcome to the team. We're asking you to commit and share our vision. It's a great orientation, great introduction to the culture of the bank. In contrast, my oldest daughter, when she was young, was so excited about New Year's Eve because she'd heard the allure of New Year's Eve and never had a chance to experience it. She's always in bed long before midnight. Until that one fateful day, we gave her permission to stay up until midnight. And I'll never forget how disappointed she was. Because we're all together and we're watching TV and wait for the ball to drop. And at the stroke of midnight, we all said, Happy New Year, and there are cheers around, and you know, we're kissing and hugging, and you know, it was all family, by the way. And then we went to bed. That was it. No fireworks. They're dangerous. Stay away from those. We're just not that adventurous. I three daughters in my house. We have things kind of relatively tame. And so she was so disappointed, though, because she had such buildup and such allure of New Year's Eve and the stroke of midnight, and it was nothing like what she expected it to be. Unfortunately, many companies do that same thing when they hire new employees. They build it up, they build themselves up, they have this anticipation, and they're talking about great benefits and great culture and all these great things that you're going to do when you come and join us, and people start, and they realize it's hard to deliver on what was promised, and people get discouraged, and they don't thrive. They fail to thrive. In his book called Drive, Daniel Pink, one of my favorite speakers, says there are three things that he thinks are needed to motivate people. They are autonomy, purpose, and mastery. Autonomy is giving people freedom to make their own decisions. Don't micromanage people, but give them the ability to be creative. In other words, don't tell me where to go. Tell me what direction to take. Or tell me where you want me to end up, and let me figure out the best way to get there. Give people some autonomy. A purpose is helping them personalize and own your culture. Understanding that doing something with a cause, something that is meaningful. And mastery, let me be great at what I do. Let me excel. support me in my growth and development. That's never as important as it is when you're working with a younger generation. They want to be better off working for you than working for somebody else. Or what's in it for me? Am I going to grow? Will I benefit? And what can you give me? I'll come and work for you, but what's in it for me? What does your organization do in terms of its culture, its plumbing? I love the example of a stoplight because it's very simple, and I'm a simple guy. A stoplight has three colors, red, yellow, and green. I know you know that. But I say that because for me, it represents three different things. It's a stop, start, and continue. I love to ask my team, what are the things we're doing? Tell me honestly, what are we doing that adds no value that we should stop doing? We do it, but it has no value. What is something that we should start? We have not been doing, but we should. And then what are some things we're doing that you really appreciate and value? What should we continue? Stop, start, and continue. True story, several years ago, I was new in a role, and there were just two of us in HR. So I was asking a lot of questions, spending a lot of time with our payroll manager, my counterpart, and at one point she walked in and she said, I just want you to know, for the next couple of weeks, I will be immersed in this project, getting benefit statements ready for our employees. I can't do anything else but work on this project for the next couple of weeks. I said, tell me more. She said, well, we don't have systems in place to generate this information, and every year we produce this benefit statement for everybody, and so I have to pull information from all over the place. It's different places, and it's personalized. It has to be right, and it's salary and benefits and taxes and retirement contributions, and if you have kids, the whole thing. And she said, it's a lot of work. So I said, what happens if you don't do it? She said, we do this every year. I mean, are you crazy? I know you're new here, but trust me, this is important. And I said, let's try something. I'm new, I'll take the blame if this goes south, but just this once, let's try not doing that this year. If it's that much work, let's just see what happens. She thought I was crazy because she does this every year and had for a long time, hours and hours of work. So she said, okay, you're taking the blame. I'll go along, but I'm reluctant. And you know, the time came and went for these benefit statements and not a single person noticed. Not one person missed their benefit statement. She couldn't believe it. And we haven't done a benefit statement since. I'm not against the value of this document that shows how much an employer invests and what they do and the whole package. It's a great thing if it can be done well, if it's easy, if it's valued. If it's not, stop doing them. And we haven't done one since. I've got stories, but I want to be careful about my time. The pandemic taught us many things, and one of those was that work can be done from home. A lot of employers are nervous about that now that the pandemic is largely over and we've asked people to come back to work. There are people who don't want to come back to work. They want to work from home. And that's really pushing many of us out of our comfort zones. I say many of us because I'm uncomfortable with that too. It's hard to know that people are working if they're not in the building. Although, let's be honest, if people are in the building, you don't know that they're actually working either. In full disclosure, I'm here with you. My boss thinks I just went to the bathroom. Sometimes it pushes us outside our comfort zones, but we need to make sure that we're understanding what our employees are looking for, how we can meet their needs. Are there things that can be done from home or remotely? And if so, why not support that? Why not allow it? Not every job can be done remotely. Let's just say that. But those that can, why not? Once you have a compelling case to share with people, you understand the need for poetry. Once you work on the plumbing, eliminate the stuff that is distraction, streamline bureaucracy, then you can really focus on what's most important, and that is hiring the right people, making sure that you get the right people in the right places in your organization. I've become a big fan of the phrase, the most important decision your organization will make is the next person you choose to hire. I want to say that one more time. It's not unique to me, but I love it. The most important decision your organization will make is the next person you choose to hire. A couple of quick examples of people maybe not making the brightest decisions when they've hired people. We're not too far from Notre Dame. I don't want to offend anybody, but they have a football team, and it depends where your loyalties lie, whether or not you think that's a good thing or not. But the University of Notre Dame hired a football coach several years ago by the name of George O'Leary. Name ring a bell with anybody? George O'Leary. He followed the Lou Holtz era and came with great pomp and circumstance, and the whole campus was abuzz because they have a new head football coach. His name is, by George, it's O'Leary, the t-shirt said. And he was on a nationwide recruiting tour, attracting students to come and play for him. And then the HR department at Notre Dame realized he had embellished his resume. First, he claimed to have had experience he didn't have. Okay, maybe that wasn't a deal breaker, but then he also claimed to have a degree from a school they did not verify. The school could not verify. What an embarrassment to the University of Notre Dame. He was hired to be a football coach. It didn't really matter much about where he got his degree or what it was in, but the fact that it wasn't accurate was the problem and a huge black eye for the university. They fired him. They made it easy for him to leave, and they moved on. And their HR department now, I can tell you, they're much more diligent about doing that work on the front end of hires across campus, because that's a big deal. Especially in this era of artificial intelligence and ChatGPT, don't assume that just because you see it in writing, it's true. It might not be. Several years ago, I had a chance to call references on a fairly high-profile individual we were going to hire. The president asked me to call references. I think we probably all will admit and understand you only put references on your resume of people you know will say nice things about you. Can we agree on that? In this case, though, I called four references. Three of them said, I wouldn't hire him. I said, what? You're on his resume. I know. But here's the thing. They each said individually. I didn't call them all together. They each said to me, we know who he is. We know his strengths. We know the organization you represent. We know what you're all about. He's a great guy. He'll do well, but not in this role, not at this time. Three of his four references said, I wouldn't recommend him for this job. We hired him anyway. It didn't end well. But that's not the point. The point is, I know there's a point there somewhere. The point is, it's important to do your due diligence, even when you're hiring people who list references, who you know, who you think highly of. Don't cut corners, because you don't want to end up with a George O'Leary or references saying, I wouldn't hire him. The Hawthorne studies are a fascinating study for me, the Hawthorne effect. If you're not familiar, several years ago, early 1900s, the Hawthorne Electric Company was trying to figure out what the optimal lighting was in a factory setting to make sure people could be most productive. So what they did was they dimmed the lights and then walked around with clipboards and white coats, and they're asking employees what they thought about the current working environment. And they're taking notes and getting input, and much to their surprise, productivity went up. People were more engaged, they were producing more stuff, and so they thought, okay, we're on to something now. So they dimmed the lights again and then went back out on the floor, and they're asking people, okay, what do you think now? And people responded well, and things are going great. Productivity went up, and they thought, this is really good stuff. And so then they thought, what if we go the other direction? And so they improved, they raised the lights. They had more lighting installed. They went around and they're talking to people, and productivity went up. The Hawthorne study was a dismal failure because it didn't matter what the lighting and the environment was. What mattered was people were listened to. People were asked their opinion, they were able to give input, and they saw the company make changes based on what they said and what they thought. That was huge. And for me, it was a brilliant takeaway. I wasn't alive when that happened. That was in the early 1900s. But I love reading about it and studying it because the experiment failed, but the lessons are true, just as true today as they were 100 years ago. So, just a few weeks ago, I had an experience where we hired a young man, and he had stubbed his toe a bit with some early communications. He was rubbing people the wrong way. And I thought, okay, this isn't going to go well because he doesn't understand this culture. He doesn't understand how he's coming across. He has a blind spot that he needs to be aware of. So I sat him down. I didn't want to overreact, but I said, I just want you to be aware. Not everybody is appreciating the way you're communicating to them. I didn't know how he would react to that. Much to my pleasure, he not only reacted well, but he came back to me shortly after that and he said, I want to tell you something. Years ago, I worked for a company and applied for a job and was asked in that job setting how I would react, how I have reacted to handling negative criticism at work. He said, it really threw me for a loop because I had never received negative criticism at work. No one ever told me how I could improve. And in his mind, that was a real negative for his current employer because he said, they never told me how I could improve. I know I'm not perfect. I know there's things I could be doing better. No one would be straight with me and give me that input. So he not only took it well, but he was glad that he was given something he could use to improve and realize, you're a great employee, doing a good job. If you could refine this, you'll be even better. So creating an environment where people can thrive isn't always about giving them what they want. Sometimes, it's not about lighting. It's about being straight, giving honest feedback, and giving them what they need to be successful. One more story, and I'll wrap things up. A few weeks ago, I had a chance to visit one of our locations. And I tell this carefully because I don't want to offend. It was in a largely Mennonite Amish community. And I say that because I want you to understand what I'm about to tell you, which this woman walked in because she needed to take some money from her account. And I was visiting, you know, someone from corporate on site, and I'm asking a lot of questions and looking at technology, and I was behind the teller line and asking the teller how she does her job. This woman walked up, and the teller said, you know, can I have your name? The reason the location is important, the Mennonite kind of Amish community, because she used a name that was very common in that community. Something like, I want to protect her identity, but it was something like Mary Yoder. I mean, it was a very common name. Standing behind the teller, I could see she typed in Mary Yoder, and on her screen, there were like 62 references of Mary Yoder. So she knew she had to figure out which one this is so she can give her money from her account. So she said, Mary, do you have your ID with you? So Mary is fumbling in her purse and trying to she couldn't find her license. She didn't have any ID. So she was visibly shaken, but she didn't have it. Teller said, no problem, Mary, that's fine. Do you know your member number? If any of you know your member number, pie is on me. I mean, that's okay. Predictably, Mary did not know her member number. She was clueless. Mary, that's fine. Can you verify the last four digits of your social security number? She could not. So then the teller said, Mary, can you tell me the name of anybody else on your account? And at that point, when the member mentioned the name of her husband, our teller realized she had just lost her husband, like the day before. Suddenly, everything changed. That clicked with our teller. She said, Mary, can I give you a hug? She left the teller line, went out into the lobby, and for the next several minutes, just cared for this woman. listening, making sure that her needs were met. Her job as a teller was to verify her identity and to give her money from her account. That's what she wanted. But our employee felt confident. Even with me standing behind, watching what was going on, she felt so confident knowing my job or my role here is so much more than just being a human ATM. It was caring for this woman in her time of need. And that was so touching for me because I realized she felt confident in her role. She was thriving, not because she knew how to do her job, but because she did more than her job. And it was a tremendous reminder to me that it's all about people. It's all about hiring the right people. It's about investing in them, caring for them, letting them care for customers. If you really want to create an environment where people can thrive at work, I maintain it's about three things. It's a focus on poetry, giving people inspiration. It's a focus on plumbing, making sure that your bureaucracy and your policies are set up to give people freedom to their jobs. And then it's a focus on the people themselves. Thank you very much.